There's been a long-term shift from manufacturing jobs to service work, and our next guest is tracking what that means for workers and for the economy. In new research, he says there's an increasing polarization in our workforce between a small number of higher-skilled workers and a growing number of lower-paid service workers with little hope of boosting their income. David Otter joins us now. He's a professor of economics at MIT. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first, how big a shift has there been from manufacturing to service employment in the United States?
Well, that shift from manufacturing to service employment has been going on for a very long time. In fact, the sort of high point of U.S. manufacturing was, you know, shortly after the end of the Second World War, when something like 40% of U.S. workers were in manufacturing. So we've been moving into the service economy for decades. What's more recent is the movement into so-called service occupations. Let me be clear what I mean by that. So the service sector, not manufacturing, is kind of everything from software to hospitals. It's just, you know, stuff that isn't making goods. Service occupations are occupations that involve helping, assisting, or caring for other people. They might include, you know, food service, security, home health aids, cleaning, landscaping, things like that. These are jobs that require kind of dexterity, flexibility, typically spoken language, but not a lot of formal training or education beyond kind of basic literacy and sometimes basic numeracy. And so they're jobs that can be done by a lot of people. So on the one hand, that's good. It means that they're open, they're accessible. On the other hand, that's not good, but because it means the skills to do them are not scarce, and so they tend not to be highly paid.
So if people are relying on a job like this for their career, as opposed to a manufacturing job or a high-skill, high-paid job, what are their income prospects through life?
In general, they're quite modest. Jobs of the type I'm describing typically have relatively low pay. They comprise a disproportionate share of minimum wage jobs, and also very low limited security because, as said, the skills are broadly available, meaning that people are relatively interchangeable. So, you know, it's not that hard to replace a food service worker or a cleaning worker relative to someone who has specialized knowledge in manufacturing technology or in you know, the way your particular office or business works. And so I think the combination of relatively modest income potential and not a lot of job security, it makes those jobs difficult for a primary earner.
And if I'm looking at your research right, for the most part, once somebody enters into this career path, there's a good chance they're going to be there to stay.
Well, you know, it depends. I mean, many people do that type of work as a youngster. You know, I worked in food service when I was a kid, when I was a teenager and young adult. It's a question, I think it's more likely if you don't have more formal training or skills, it's harder to, there's not so much a career ladder in that type of work, right? So, being a waitress or security guard, a janitor, you're usually limited upward mobility options in that type of work. You won't go typically from doing that job to running the company.
How has pay progressed over the years for these service occupations?
Well, so looking, you know, in general, looking across advanced economies, wages and service occupations are tend to be at the bottom of the distribution. In the U.S., we've had very slow growth in lower-paying jobs for a very long time. In general, wage growth in the U.S. has been slow since the early 1980s, but it's been much slower at the bottom than at the top. In fact, at the top, it's been quite rapid. And so pay has not advanced rapidly. There was a period in the 1990s when, you know, associated with this sort of the dot-com bubble, when everyone's earnings were growing and wages in service occupations actually grew a little bit faster in percentage terms than the average, but still from a very low base. But the 2000s have not been particularly kind for relatively lower paid workers, and so wage growth again has been modest in those occupations or even non-existent. Ironically, the fastest job growth during the 2000s has occurred in relatively low-paying in-person service jobs. Maybe I should say a few words about where that type of employment growth is coming from. So, you know, we talked about initially the movement from manufacturing into services, and why are people moving into these service occupations? A very important reason, well, actually, yeah, one of the most important reasons, arguably, is the nature of technological change, which has made it increasingly easy to substitute machinery, computer-driven machinery, for people doing formerly skilled but relatively rules-based tasks. So if you think about a lot of production line work or even office clerical work, that's work that's that often follows sort of well-scripted procedures that required, you know, educated people to follow those procedures carefully. But increasingly, we've gotten good at getting computers to follow procedures carefully. So, you know, whether it's storing, filing, and retrieving information, or whether it's, you know, moving parts around dexterously on an assembly line, increasingly we have machines that can do those types of tasks. What we don't have machines that are good at are, on the one hand, a lot of very highly skilled work like that's associated with medicine and science and engineering, where you're you know, developing hypotheses, solving new problems, creating products. Some of those things can be automated, but many of those things require kind of creativity and intuition that we don't really know how to automate yet. We may someday, but arguably those jobs are complemented. On the other hand, another set of jobs that we're also not good at automating are things that require people to be very flexible, to work in an uncertain environment. So, for example, you know, it's easy at this point, comparatively easy to make a robot that can install a windshield on a car on an assembly line, because that's a very well-controlled environment with very little variation. However, you would not have a robot coming out to your house to replace the windshield that broke on your car, because that requires a person who can work in an unfamiliar situation where, you know, each car would be different, each setting is different. And so jobs that require people to be physically adaptive, to visually recognize things, to navigate in a kind of uncertain terrain, those things still very much require human skills. So that describes, waiting tables, that describes working on a construction site, that describes, even cleaning a house. You know, your vacuum cleaner can't walk upstairs and clean the upstairs for you, even though you'd like it to. And so that means that there's lots of work for people to do that won't be automated. But unfortunately, those skills, although they're very difficult to automate, they're very relatively easy for humans, which makes them abundant. I should also say, by the way, a second factor that makes these jobs particularly durable in terms of not being subject to other forces that tend to push against them is that they also mostly need to be done in person. In other words, if you're going to get a haircut or go for a meal or have
your house cleaned, you can't get an e-haircut.
Yeah, that doesn't have to. You can't get that done overseas. It can't be traded, and so that means, again, you know, if they're not subject to this sort of technological replacement at the moment, and they're not subject to trade, that means they will be done by workers. So it means they're relatively abundant, but again, not relatively high paying.
So if you've got this polarization, the higher skilled, less replaceable jobs at the top, and then the jobs we're mostly talking about here, where a lot of people can potentially do them, this polarization of what people are getting paid, what has you most worried about that? We hear a lot about income inequality. Is that a problem societally as well as for the people who aren't getting paid much money?
Yes, I would say there are several problems. So in general, it certainly contributes to inequality of income when you have a lot of, a fair amount of very relatively low paid employment, and then a stratum of very high paid at the top. That's one issue. But in terms of the what I worry about even more directly is sort of the quality of opportunity for individuals in those positions. So if you don't have the good fortune to, you know, go to college and get a highly skilled job, if you just have a high school education or maybe some college and you don't find your way into something that has like a medical paraprofession or manufacturing or an office job that has some durability, then these positions are not going to offer the kind of wage growth over a lifetime or employment security that people that's so desirable, especially if you're responsible for a family. So I think on the one hand, the the pay is low. It's also, if you jobs don't offer opportunity, that's also typically discouraging. So it, I think it detracts from the enjoyment of work, and people want to and need to enjoy their work, or hopefully at least that we want them to, and I'm sure they want to. And I equally well worry that that affects the kind of quality of opportunity they can offer to their own children, because if you have limited resources, it's harder to send your kids to good schools, to make the kind of investments of time and resources in providing opportunity for them. So I worry that it ultimately not only reduces opportunities for workers in these positions, but reduces, can potentially reduce mobility in our society, the chance that their kids have better opportunities.
MIT economist David Otter is with us, talking about a growing divide in the workforce, with more and more people in service jobs with little prospect for better paying work. And you can join in. Are we talking about you? Do you work in one of these service occupations we've been talking about? Do you see a chance for better pay in your future, either with the job you're in or by making some kind of change? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org. We pick up our conversation now with David Otter, professor of economics at MIT. His latest research looks at the growing number of people doing lower-paying work in service occupations, everything from food service, home health care, a lot of other things like that, and seeing little hope for increased pay over their careers. You can join in. Are you doing this kind of work now? Are you worried about the impact of people making more money at higher skilled professions and a lot of people not having the prospects to do that at the lower end? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org. Get your calls in just a few moments. But David, are there policy changes that you think your research might point to? Are there things that aren't, that the government isn't doing that maybe they ought to be?
Well, a controversial but well liked by the populace and increasingly accepted policy by economists is the minimum wage. For non-traded activities like many of these service occupations, there's headroom where one could raise earnings without seeing the jobs go overseas. And although, canonical economic theory says if you make something more expensive, you get less of it, so, there's always a danger of raising wages too high such that they lower employment. The evidence that we've seen over the last 20 years suggests that U.S. minimum wages are just not high enough to really have a big adverse effect on employment. So in general, raising the minimum wage is one way to increase the real earnings of workers without having, as far as we can tell, substantial consequences, adverse consequences on employment. So there's room to do that. In addition, I actually think the new healthcare law should actually improve the quality of life for many individuals who'd be doing relatively low-paid work, because traditionally those people have earned enough that they haven't qualified for Medicaid, but not enough that employers are going to be providing health care for them. So I actually think that's a big policy step in the right direction. The earned income tax credit is another policy we've had that's been very successful at making work pay for people who don't have great labor market options. And I would actually like to see that expanded. In particular, the earned income tax credit is targeted at families with dependent children, but people doing service occupations could be older individuals or middle-aged individuals without children, could be unmarried men, et cetera. And I don't see any reason why we wouldn't also want to help make work pay better for them.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Joe on the line in Prairie du Chien. Joe, hi.
Hi. I'm curious to get thoughts. Are we in a position where we are going into the spiral of servicing ourselves in our economy and not addressing the world market? Are we going down a slippery slope where we will not be competitive as the future unfolds?
That's an interesting question. I think that yes, the U.S. has certainly lost some competitive ground in producing manufactured goods. U.S. manufacturing employment has fallen very substantially, actually, over the last decade. The U.S. continues to be a producer of high value-added goods, but in terms of employment, much, much less so. Increasingly, we do export services like banking services and business services. But I do think, yes, there is a concern that you know, that many of these positions have, you know, the issue, a long-standing problem with service-type positions is they have relatively low productivity growth over time. We just don't get better at them much faster. And so that means it's harder for real standing living standards to rise much faster. So if you think about what a barber does or a concert musician does or even what a teacher does, those are all important jobs, but they, you know, the rate of progress in getting, you know, better at haircutting or making concert music or teaching is really quite slow over the course of decades, and so I do think that is it does kind of create a long term drag on productivity.
Thanks for the question, Joe. We'll go to Jocelyn in Sheboygan now. Jocelyn, hi.
Hi. I call this economic slavery. The exploitation of people, especially now when there are no jobs or very few. You know, they were saying it's three people to one job, and probably it's even more than that. But also when NAFTA was signed, I think that was a death knell for this country. And also I heard or read somewhere that also it affected Mexico in an adverse way.
All right, I want to jump in, Jocelyn, and get a guest response. First, on NAFTA, how much is, you touched on it briefly, I think, earlier, but how much is globalization a factor in the decline of the higher-paying jobs that these service jobs are replacing?
Well, globalization, actually much more competition from China than Mexico, has been an important factor in the decline of U.S. manufacturing employment over the last 20 years, and especially in the last 10. I actually think the importance of NAFTA per se was probably oversold by both critics and advocates 20 years ago. However, the rise of and probably had more consequences in Mexico, not all of them positive, not all of them negative. China's rise as a very low-cost, high-quality, productive country that's also very large over the last 20 years has certainly displaced a lot of labor-intensive U.S. manufacturing in textiles and footwear and rubber products. And so that has reduced U.S. manufacturing employment substantially.
But on the other hand, how much is the, and again, you touched on this briefly earlier, is increasing use of technology taking away the jobs? Because one worker now does the job with the robots helping him or her of many workers in the past.
I think technology is the larger factor. I think most economists would agree with that. And even many of these labor-intensive positions, if they were not traded, would in fact see declining employment over time. Now, there's a plus side to these things as well. Technological change makes us more productive. It contributes to national wealth. Trade also allows us to perform things in which we have comparative advantage, also contributes to national wealth. However, those gains are not generally broadly shared or not necessarily broadly shared. You know, national wealth can be growing while some people are getting very rich and others are getting pretty poor. So I think the difficulty with both the technological change and these trade forces is they kind of both contributed to eroding opportunities in the middle, boosting opportunities at the top and not doing much for people who don't have high levels of education. And so the prosperity has not been broadly shared.
We had economist Tyler Cowen on the show, and he was making kind of similar a case for the future of this polarized economy. And to sum it up in a nutshell, his argument was, it's going to happen. Adjust your expectations if you're in this lower half. Enjoy the fact that we have fairly cheap stuff to buy with your limited income. Is that it? Is that the best hope for people in these service occupations?
No, I'm familiar with Tyler's work, and I think he's a very interesting, provocative thinker. But I think that's extrapolating a little bit too far from what we actually know. One of my mentors often says, look, I enjoy science fiction and I enjoy history, but I believe in more in history than I do in science fiction. and that's a pretty extreme view. I think there's we've gone, for example, if we were having this conversation that we're 1999, we'd just be talking about the wonderful decade we had of technological change with rising incomes and all kinds of new opportunities. And so I think that, you know, economic growth will return. I think there will be opportunity, but it's crucial to craft policy to help us take advantage of it. Over the long term, the policies that are most effective are investing in the skills of our workforce and investing in the education of younger people.
But I always wonder when people say that, if the jobs out there don't require this high-skilled training, how much help is skills training going to be?
Well, so there are many high-skilled jobs. In fact, the wages of college graduates and people with post-college education have risen substantially over the last three decades. And if we'd had more college graduates and fewer non-college, there would have been more shared prosperity. On the one hand, I think that's important. Also, the point I made earlier, the wages of these jobs are determined by the supply of people available to do them. So if there are relatively few people who can do them or who want to do them because they have better opportunities, those jobs will have to pay higher wages.
Are you an optimist looking ahead, especially with the generational issue you mentioned earlier? The expectation was always that our kids would be a little better off than us. A lot of people are thinking that's not the case anymore. Is it going to be again?
I think it will be. I just don't think we're not. I don't think the U.S. is going to have the type of extraordinary year over year, decade over decade growth rates that we saw after the end of the Second World War up through the mid 1970s. That three decade period, which everyone sort of views as the U.S. normal, is an extremely exceptional period for any period of U.S. history, any period of world history. However, I don't think we're on a downward slide where living standards will be falling and there will be no employment and sort of we'll have a mass disruption of the type of economic system that we have enjoyed. I think there are challenges. I think that we will not have, incredibly rapid growth across the board, but I'm not as pessimistic as many.
David, thanks a lot for joining us and spending time with us today.
Okay, pleasure talking with you. Thanks for the great questions. Thanks to your callers as well.
That was David Otter, professor of economics at MIT.